Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Glad that you are with us today. Coming up, Prairie Plates. We'll go inside two familiar Bismarck Mandan restaurants, and the Zemed brothers are bringing the unmistakable harmonies of the Everly brothers to Pelican Rapids this weekend. And we begin today in Horace, where voters may soon decide whether to shorten the city's legal fireworks season from 10 days to 3. Prairie Beat examines how a citizen-led petition gained enough support to move the issue toward the November ballot.
Well, hello, hello. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thanks for joining us again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
That's our weekly news podcast from us here at Prairie Public. Danielle, what's on the beat this week?
Well, we have a little bit of an update to a recent story we had just this summer. It was, as I believe you put it at the time, a fairly explosive topic about some residents of Horace gathering petition signatures to amend the city's fireworks ordinance.
These were the folks who were interested in shortening the number of days you can legally blow up fireworks in the city. And I remember the current ordinance being pretty lenient compared to other cities of similar size.
Yeah, that's right. So a big part of the story, of course, is just how much Horace has grown in recent years. According to the last census, like we mentioned last time, in 2020, just over 3,000 people were living in Horace at the time. But today, in 2026, it's estimated that just over 7,800 people live there. And that's a growth of 135%.
Wow.
There's a lot going on down in Horace, what with all the growing pains and things you got to learn when your community explodes in size like that. And in recent years, there have been some local residents who have brought up making some amendments to that fireworks ordinance. What's on the books now is that you can blow them up in the city limits for 10 days leading up to the 4th of July. And this summer, these residents were willing to do more than just talk about changing that.
Alan Turnmeyer, Horace, North Dakota resident.
Yes. I remember Alan Turnmeyer quite well now that you mention it, Danielle. He and his wife got that petition going, some citizen activism right there. And that story really, blew up.
Yeah, it really did, both in the media and online, of course. Now, this whole time, Alan and his wife, Karen, have been pretty clear. They are not looking to cancel the 4th of July. But with the population growth and Horace not really being much of a small town anymore, they and others felt it was really time to look at making some changes. In the last episode, we talked about how, you know, it's not really just about not liking fireworks. There are some issues and also people to consider, like the elderly, children, pets, maybe veterans with PTSD, residents who have sensory issues, other things. And with a growing community like this, you will naturally have more of these folks. And then, of course, you will also have more people blowing up fireworks, too. Alan Turnmeyer has said, you know, 10 days is a really long time to have all these fireworks blowing up all over the place. And not everyone can just pick up and leave town for that amount of time. So what they did was they looked at cities of similar size and what they had on their books, and they were thinking that 3 days was a pretty good compromise.
So we started the petition, I want to say mid-June, if I'm not mistaken, to reduce the firework ordinance down from 10 days down to 3 days, while preserving the holiday, obviously. So we were just entailing the 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
Yeah, you know, I still think that's a pretty good proposal. I mean, I'm not really a fireworks guy, Danielle, as you know. I just can't get used to the idea of us normal folks, if you will, buying them and lighting them off. I say leave it to the professionals. Maybe that's just the coastal elite in me, but I didn't grow up in a small town. But this still gives people a few days. You know, 3 days I think is pretty good, okay? I mean, 3 days of interrupted sleep, it's much better than 10, so folks can use them legally, and it gives others a much more reasonable window of time to get out of Dodge if they want to avoid them altogether. But I know that not everyone felt that way.
They really did not. And we talked about that last time, too. You know, Alan and Karen Turnmeyer wanted to get about 600 signatures on this petition and needed to get the word out about it. But once the story hit the news and social media, it was pretty intense. Alan told me at the time there were some personal attacks against him and his family, and he really did not appreciate that. This week, when I talked to him again, though, he said that's thankfully really calmed down. But he also had some pretty interesting updates to report. Now, they were originally aiming for those 600 signatures because they were initially told they needed 514 by the end of July. And that was a figure that was told to them by the Horace City Council, but then they got some clarification from the city administrator.
Further investigation came down to only 500 and some people voted in the last presidential election, which is part of the Home Rule Charter that you need 15% of how many people actually voted in the last presidential election. So 15% of that ended up being about 70.5. So he rounded up to 71, and we actually surpassed that. We had in the neighborhood of 250 plus signatures at the time we were actually given the right number.
So now hold up. The petition threshold was not based on the population, but a percentage of how many people voted in the last presidential election, which was just in 2024. And how many people was that, Danielle?
470 people.
Okay, wow. That's a commentary on participation. No, that is pretty wild. Out of several thousand residents, only 470 voted in that last election.
Yeah, pretty crazy. So it turns out they did not need hundreds of signatures. They only needed that 71. And now they had what they needed. What happened next was the city administrator told Allen the council had some options. They could either meet with the sponsoring committee, they could adopt the ordinance themselves, or they could put it up for a public vote. And he says they really wanted the public to weigh in. They have until the next council meeting to finalize the ballot measure language. But the council did meet this week on Monday. Allen says they were very eager to get the question in front of voters this November. So that will need to be finalized and sent to the Secretary of State's office by August 31st.
Okay, end of the month. That's coming up now. The civic process working for the people of Horace, one step and one rule at a time. That is really wild, though, about that voter turnout. I can't quite get over that.
I know. Allen told me, you know, turnout across North Dakota is usually pretty low, too. And, you know, I've covered elections here for a long time. I'm pretty familiar with that phenomenon. But sometimes in some elections, it really does take a hot topic, a controversial measure, maybe even a charismatic candidate to be on the ballot. And that can really energize voters to want to come out. Now, Allen says, you know, he's hopeful that this will be the case with this measure. He says he does not believe that just one vote doesn't count. It's that all voices are being heard.
You know, you want your voice heard. You've got to make it heard. And if you want change, you have to, you know, do something about it. You can't just stand idly by and hope whatever you want will happen. You can't do that in today's world. You got to make sure your voice is heard.
Well, and it really sounds to me that these are folks who, you know, they might be hoping this ballot measure goes one way over the other way, but at the end of the day, just as long as people of Horace stand up and are being counted on the question of 3 days of fireworks instead of 10, he really sounds like he thinks that's the most important thing of all, that you hear that question, make that decision, and go out and vote. So he's really into turning his civic activism into civic participation. That's really just a way of kind of getting things done, getting people off the couch over any arguments on the dreaded social media comment section.
Yeah. He also told me he's hoping the interest in this measure might inspire even more civic engagement in Horace in the future. In a community that has grown as rapidly as Horace has, it's definitely had its own challenges. They've been in the news for other things, you know, like their special assessments in the newer developments. Allen says it's always a good thing when citizens become more aware of their own power to affect change in their communities.
You know, I would love to see a good turnout on this just because then it shows the community is actually actively participating in any changes that possibly happen. And, you know, I do want to call out, you know, those who supported us. I appreciate all the support along the way. And those who oppose it, you know, like I said, you know, make sure your voice is heard on the ballot box, regardless of which way it goes.
Well, it would appear that in addition to all the exciting midterm election races that you and the news team will be following in November for sure, a local ballot measure in good old Horace, North Dakota will also be one result to watch for. Thanks for all that, Danielle. What else has been in Z News this week at Prairie Public?
The Public Service Commission is getting ready to hold hearings on the North Plains Connector Project. Governor Armstrong is calling a special session of the legislature next month to ban a substance called kratom. And 1 year after becoming law, North Dakota's state superintendent says the state's bell-to-bell cell phone ban in schools is having some very positive results.
I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, kids learning now instead of scrolling and being distracted. I can't really argue against that, honestly.
No.
That's kind of a no-brainer. Well, I certainly am interested to see what lawmakers come up with in that special session for sure. They rarely get together without bringing up some other issues, and this would be their second special session this year. That's a pretty rare occurrence.
Yeah, Dave told me he thinks it's been around 25 years or so since that's happened. So, yeah, stay tuned. More to come on that.
Yeah, you know Dave's going to be on top of that. Thanks for all that today, Danielle, keeping us up to date on all these North Dakota headlines.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news, or check out our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that'll do it for us this week on Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Prairie Beat drops on Wednesdays. Grab it wherever you get your podcasts.
Theater Without Walls presents The Cream of Wheat Caper, a melodrama on the Red River, August 15th and 22nd at 7 p.m. and August 16th and 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Myra Museum in Grand Forks. The production is supported by an arts re-grant from the City of Grand Forks, with additional support from the Community Foundation of Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and Region.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Eon, and as always, we have special guests on talking about food, restaurants, what they're up to, new places, and that's what we're going to focus on today. And we're taking you to Bismarck, Mandan to visit with Michelle Kaufman with the North Dakota Hospitality Group, which is very busy lately remodeling and opening some new places in the Bismarck, Mandan area. Michelle, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michelle, tell us a little bit about your organization, North Dakota Hospitality Group. Obviously, you've been very busy lately.
So we decided to kind of group together all of the businesses that I'm affiliated with, but I have partners throughout several of these ventures as well. So we all, you know, work together, collaborate together, share ideas, help each other out. But there are then different ownership mixes between the different businesses inside of the group.
And you have a lot of establishments that you run, including, you know, the Paddle Trap is very iconic place on the river in Mandan, Shakers on Third. There are some new ones, though, that are onboarding.
In addition to the Paddle Trap and Shakers, I am also owner or part owner of three wedding venues and event businesses here in town. And then we have recently taken over the lease on River Road, where the riverboat operates out of, and then also the lease in downtown in the Patterson Hotel.
And so that's the Heritage River Landing, formerly Huckleberry House, and then 5th and Main, which was the former Peacock Alley. But you're doing some new stuff, rebranding, new name, some remodel, new menus. It's really exciting to see. I think what you're doing in Bismarck Mandan is really great for the community.
Thank you. Yeah, we've leased the space underneath Cock Alley for the last 2 years. There's a basement bar space underneath there on Fifth Street. We've called that Fifth Underground, just for simplicity. And we've been running a steam lounge, restaurant lounge in that space for the last 2 years. So when the lease for the restaurant space upstairs became available, the landlord came to us first as a good potential fit, and we were excited to take it on.
I love basement bars. I think they're a lot of fun, but you're doing a lot of stuff upstairs. And tell us a little bit about that. I think our listeners want an update on that space at 5th and Main in downtown Bismarck.
Yes, that originally was opened in 1911 as the McKenzie Hotel by Ed Patterson. He named it the McKenzie Motel because McKenzie was a huge political figure in Bismarck at the time and really influential in a lot of different things. And so McKenzie's name is, you know, all over the state of North Dakota between, you know, counties and courthouses and different things. And you renamed it the Patterson Hotel after McKenzie passed away. But we will be bringing that restaurant space back to its originality. We've been pulling old photos from the State Historical Society and people's archives and looking at really what it looked and felt like when it first opened in 1911. and we'll be reopening the McKenzie Steakhouse and Lounge sometime, probably in early 2027 is our target. So we're going to be going higher end in the dining room. Your very typical kind of high end, you know, nice evening out steakhouse. And then going a little bit more casual in the lounge so that there's an option there as well for just your everyday night out. And then we'll be keeping the basement bar open as well. It actually connects to the restaurant upstairs. And so that'll be even, you know, more casual yet, that will be open for people that just want to come out, you know, have a drink, maybe play some casino games and that kind of thing. So three different spaces for kind of three different evenings, but it will all tie together back into the way that that McKenzie Hotel used to be.
I love those spaces. I spent a lot of time in Bismarck in a previous employer, and a lot of history, not only with McKenzie, but Wild Bill Langer, the former governor, and just many political figures over the years. So good for you for continuing that legacy. I think that's really neat. But let's switch now to an update on the Landing restaurant and bar at the Heritage River Landing. Tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on there.
So that space is a little bit more casual, riverfront. I know a lot of people have had some questions because we do have the paddle trap and there, you know, is it going to be like the paddle trap? No, we don't need two paddle traps in this area. We have one and it's awesome. And now we're going to do something a little bit different. So the Landing is going to be something that evolves throughout the year. In the summertime, when the riverboat is running, we will have designated seating for riverboat ticket holders to come enjoy some drinks, apps, food, you know, before or after their cruise. There'll also be a patio space available just for general seating, as well as our inside space, which is fairly small. So it's great. It's quaint. You know, it's very intimate, more of that kind of neighborhood bar and restaurant feel. And then our menu focus is really on hometown traditional favorites. So we sat and brainstormed, like, what are all the things that our grandmothers made that we loved? You know, what are the things that you find at cultural events that you really look forward to? So lots of variations on, you know, fry breads, you know, sandwiches, Coogan for dessert, that kind of thing that really brings that cultural heritage from all around the region into the menu.
I see things like campfire corn ribs, trophy walleye dip, a lot of tasty salads, burgers, chicken sandwiches, and yeah, the different fry breads. And I did notice the Coogan because that's really a North Dakota tradition. And it all looks great. And it's described in a way that makes me want to go there next week because I'll be in Bismarck next week. But you're not quite open yet, right?
Not quite. We really wanted to open the first week in August, which we are in the middle of right now. We're waiting on some very important equipment that was supposed to, of course, be installed, you know, weeks ago. And they, you know, keep saying we'll be there tomorrow, we'll be there tomorrow, we'll be there tomorrow. So as soon as we get the remainder of our equipment installed, then we will be ready to rock and roll. So we've got our entire team staffed. They've been through orientation and training already. We have our menu ready to go. We're just waiting on a couple of things outside of our control, but we're really hoping in the next 2 weeks for sure that we can start getting some opening going. That menu that you are looking at is our summer menu. So that will be the menu that we launch with, and then we intend to modify it throughout the year with putting some heavier, heartier things on in the wintertime, keeping things people love, trading out things maybe aren't as popular for some new ideas. So that menu will continue to evolve as we move through our first couple of years for sure.
That sounds really good, and sounds like you're on a good track besides the equipment challenges. And one of the reasons we like talking to restaurant owners and managers is because it's interesting to talk about some of those challenges. It's a lot of hard work to run these restaurants, and there are a lot of different factors that go into it. We're talking with Michelle Kaufman with the North Dakota Hospitality Group here on Prairie Plates here on Main Street today. I want to ask you, Michelle, what does it mean to your organization to have two restaurants upcoming at unique locations such as the location at 5th and Main, it's historic, and then at the Heritage River Landing?
Well, I'll tell you a story. When I first moved back to Bismarck after going to college in 2009, both Captain Merriweather's restaurant and Peacock Alley were for sale within about a year of me moving back here. And I had always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Most of my experience, you know, in high school and college was working in the restaurant industry. So that was the thing I felt the most knowledgeable about at the time. And I looked into trying to purchase both of those at different points of time back then, and neither one of them would work out. It just, timing wasn't right. I was too young. I didn't have any money. But they'd always been these kind of goals of mine. So when both spaces became available at the same time, it was just the weirdest feeling of kind of, you know, a fate that was supposed to happen. And also, oh my gosh, I can't believe that both of these things are happening at the exact same time. So it's not something that we set out and intended to do, but both were just options we just couldn't say no to. And it's very exciting. But these ideas have been in my brain for a very long time. So it's not like we had to sit down and say, oh my gosh, what are we going to do here? It's, I know exactly what I've always wanted to do here. And we're really excited to have the opportunity to do it.
So it's really a dream come true, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, a nightmare some days as well, because it's just so overwhelming with all of the challenges like you talked about. But all things that I'm very excited to face and figure out. I've got some amazing partners that I couldn't do anything without, that really move everything along and bring so much to the table. So I'm really, really lucky not just to have the opportunity, but to also have the people to help make it happen.
Anything you'd like to tell the community about your new establishments, invite them to come, anything like that? I think these two locations are just really iconic, and it's really exciting to see some new energy going into them.
It is. So the Landing will be opening very soon. If anyone is interested in, you know, dates and being the first people in the door, I just encourage them to follow our social media, because as soon as we get any updates, we will post them there immediately. And then I just ask people to be really patient with us with the McKenzie. That space has been there for a very long time. It needs a lot of work to remodel and bring some things back to where we want them to be. And it's going to take us a while. So with that one, we're, you know, shooting for the beginning of 2027. You know, as we know, all good plans, right? Like, we'll see how it rolls out. But that one's going to take us a while. So we just ask people to be patient, and they can follow along with what we're doing there on our social media as well.
We talked a little bit about the bar offerings at the new establishment at 5th and Main. But I think one of the highlights of the former restaurant at the Heritage River Landing was the bar, and they offered some really fun cocktails, beer and wine, obviously. There's a large patio there. Are you going to be offering some of those same things?
Absolutely. We have a really exciting cocktail menu. Natalie Esslinger is our bar expert at all of our locations, and she has put together a really fun cocktail list. Really fun drinks, ingredients, combinations. And we're excited to launch that. We'll probably be posting that on our social very soon. And of course, you know, beer, wine, we've got quite a few taps. So yes, full bar. It'll be really fun for everybody to try all of the new things.
And I would really encourage folks to go to the Landing's social media pages. The Facebook page is full of new menus and some really nice photos. Michelle, I'll be in Bismarck next week. I might have to check out some of your other places, like the Paddle Trap, Shakers on 3rd. I've been to the Paddle Trap before, but it's always just a fun place to visit. Your group just does very good work in Bismarck, Mandan. I think you really have a good service to the community.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, Michelle Kaufman with the North Dakota Hospitality Group, it's been a pleasure having you on Prairie Plates today.
Yes, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it. I could talk about these places all day.
Well, we'll have you back, and we can talk about the new places when they're open. You have an open invitation.
Sounds great. Thank you.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Eon. We'll talk to you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
Still ahead on Main Street, the Everly Brothers Harmonies will be carried forward this weekend in Pelican Rapids and Stanley. It all follows this news. is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and there is something distinctive about the sound of siblings singing together, a vocal connection often described as blood harmony. Zach and Dylan's Med have built their careers around that sound, originally from California's San Fernando Valley, and now based in Middle Tennessee, the brothers perform Americana music rooted in country, blues, gospel, and early rock and roll. Before forming their duo, they spent several years writing and performing with the Los Angeles indie folk rock band, The Janks. In 2015, Zach and Dylan created the Everly Brothers Experience to preserve the music and history of Don and Phil Everly. Along with their business partner and drummer, Burley Drummond Jr., they performed the Everly's classics while explaining the brothers' importance to American popular music. It's a celebration they emphasize rather than an impersonation. The Everly Brothers Experience comes to the Pelican Rapids High School Fine Arts Auditorium Friday, August 7th. The concert will raise money for the Falling Creek Players and its plans to produce a summer musical theater in Pelican Rapids. They'll perform the next day at the Sibley Center in Stanley, North Dakota. Zach Zmed joins us now. Zach, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Craig.
Zach, you and Dylan describe your music as blood harmony Americana. What is blood harmony and what makes the sound of siblings singing together just so distinctive?
Well, you had a pretty good explanation at the top there. I would say there's something unique about siblings being brought up, not just under the same roof, emulating their parents' dialect or vocal timbre, but also in whatever part of the country you're in, of course. Yet there's the genetic and the cultural and elements that come together to kind of create a sound that's greater than the sum of its parts, which it's hard to describe, but you know it when you hear it.
Zach, you grew up in California's San Fernando Valley, as I mentioned, and you're in a musical and theatrical family. What did music sound like around your house then when you and Dylan were young?
We kind of had a dual lifestyle. Our parents split up when I was 8, and my dad is an actor, singer, and dancer, doing lots of theater, Broadway. He was on Broadway in New York, national touring companies of many different shows. Then my mom is a second grade teacher in Calabasas, California, and my mom listened to a lot of Bonnie Raitt and Michael Jackson and Seal and Eric Clapton and the Cowboy Junkies, so a lot of different types of music. And she would blast the music on a really good stereo system. And it was always a kind of an emotional thing for her. She was very emotionally connected to the music. And I felt that growing up. There's something so powerful about listening to great songs on a great stereo system, for sure.
Sure.
Cleaning the house on Sundays. My dad, my experience with him was listening to him rehearse and learn plays. So much of our childhood, our dad was doing the play Grease because that was his first job in 1976. He was one of the original Danny Zukos on Broadway doing
nice.
Grease. And he did it again in the 1990s on Broadway, a different production when, my brother and I are kids. So 50s culture and all the songs in Grease are based off of actual 50s songs. We just kind of marinated in that a lot, the 50s music. But there's a lot of plays that my dad did. I mean, I could go on and on, Little Shop of Horrors, Chicago, Prelude to a Kiss, Children of Eden. There's so many shows that my dad did. So my experience with him was a lot more I got to see my dad learning music and rehearsing things on his own. So I guess those two, my mom and my dad coming together, it's quite a hodgepodge to try and find my own identity in.
And when did that change for you, Zach? When did you change from watching your mom and dad, your mom listening so emotionally to music, your dad performing and learning, hey, this is something I want to do. How can I learn how to do this? How did you learn?
Well, I was 12. I was playing from 8 to 12. I played travel ice hockey in Southern California. Can you believe it?
That resonates well here.
But,
you betcha.
But Wayne Gretzky was huge, and I was a big fan of the Kings and the Blackhawks and stuff because my parents are from Chicago originally. Honestly, I was really into 50s music, like Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and even the Everlys and such and Del Shannon, lots of cool stuff with guitar. And that's what kind of started it. But then my parents were both born in 1954, And, you know, they're kids of the late 60s and early 70s. So my mom and dad introduced me to, you know, Led Zeppelin and The Who and Yes and, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Cream. And that I totally got bit by that bug. And so I wanted to play like Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton at that particular time. And I quit hockey. I was the captain of my team. And I just put the skates down and I was like, I need to focus on guitar. How am I, you know? So I got really serious from 12 years old through high school. And I joined the jazz band in high school. It had jazz combos and had bands, little blues bands that I'd play in at high school events. And then after high school, I started my own band when I was going to college and at Cal State Northridge in the San Fernando Valley of California. And my brother is 4 years younger than me. He was still doing his own thing, going to art school. And it wasn't until he graduated from college that he joined my band. And it was kind of, you know, the band was called The Janks, and it was a mixture of indie music, folk music, heavier stuff. I mean, all the influences I've kind of laid out to some degree, all original music. And then when that band fell apart, my brother and I were the two people left standing. And we just thought, you know what, let's really focus on singing together in close harmony. And we started gigging around the greater Los Angeles area as a duo, playing like 3 hour long gigs at wine bars, bistros, you know, clubs, bars. And we learned about 10 Everly Brothers songs in that mix, you know, but it was a wide array of music, Bob Dylan, you know, blues music and stuff. But every time we play an Everly Brothers song, people that were around our age in their 20s and 30s would come up and say, I love that song. Who is it? So we just started noticing, gosh, people know these songs, but they don't know who sang them. That was kind of the impetus for us deciding to start the Everly Show.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Zach Zmed. With former hockey player, there we go, Zach Zmed. He and his brother Dylan are part of the Everly Brothers Experience, and they'll be coming to Pelican Rapids High School Fine Arts Auditorium on Friday, August 7th. The concert will raise money for Falling Creek Players and its plans to produce summer musical theater in Pelican Rapids, and they'll be performing the next day at the Sibley Center, and that's in Stanley, North Dakota. So, Zach, if a young person comes up to you and says, you know, I know that song, I've heard it before, who do you tell them the Everly Brothers are?
I would say that the Everly Brothers are, they're the pivot point between the early radio and basically the mid 20th century. They are the pivot point between all the early radio acts and then the, what we know as kind of the modern record industry. So they carried on a long tradition of family singing together in harmony. They weren't the first to do it. They were carrying a torch, but they were definitely the first ones that popularized that blood harmony sound in the context of country and rhythm and blues coming together along with what we know as modern marketing. You know, they're preceded by the Leuven Brothers, the Bales Brothers, the York Brothers, the Dixon Brothers. There's so many. And then you can also just go with family acts like the Carter family or the Stoneman family, the Dzirek sisters. They're from Minnesota. And their father, Ike Everly, was this brilliant guitar player out of Muhlenberg County that played thumb picking style and taught Merle Travis how to play in that style. He's one of the early pioneers of that style. So Ike was knew the tradition, and he taught Don and Phil all these old songs. So when, you know, Don and Phil, you know, they had their first big hits with Bye Bye Love and Wake Up Little Susie, All I Have to Do is Dream. But their second full-length record was a tribute to old country and old radio acts called Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. This, obviously, this is not what I would be telling someone in a bar, but this is how I kind of explain it now. I would always just tell them that they're the most successful sibling duo of all time.
Wow.
That's probably the simplest way of putting it.
You make a point of saying that you are not an impersonator. What is the difference between impersonating Don and Phil Everly and honoring their music in your voices?
In the same way that Don and Phil were honoring all of the sibling acts that preceded them, my brother and I consider ourselves just another another little note in that long tradition. We're just playing our part in that long tradition of family singing together. We put on a show that has multimedia. There's a timeline, and we tell Don and Phil's story, and we also tell a little bit of our own story and see how where we fit into this American story as well. But we're just much more interested in telling a story rather than pretending to be other people. I mean, aesthetically, we wear the suits and try and dress nice and be gentlemanly like the Everly Brothers. It's just not where our interest laid. And so we just didn't go down that path. No offense to acts that decide to impersonate.
You also write and perform original music, and you explore a much broader range of American roots traditions. It sounds to me like, Zach, you've immersed yourself in a part of America that allows you and your brother to really do that. Tell us more about your time here in Middle Tennessee.
Middle Tennessee feels like the heart of American music, because we're within, 5 hours of so many American, birth genres. So, whether it's bluegrass, country, soul, blues, and even jazz, from Eastern Tennessee to Nashville to Memphis to Clarksdale, Mississippi, even down to New Orleans. It's a special place to be just for that, just to be close to the history, because I'm constantly thinking about the people whose shoulders we're standing on and people who built these genres. And we just love all this music so much.
Zach, has the Everly Brothers influenced the way you write today? You talk about standing on their shoulders. What do you mean by that? How does it influence then what you want to bring forward yourself?
I will say that a lot of the Everly Brothers music was definitely very, in terms of content, a lot of it was very sweet, that's for sure. They had some great writers, the Felice and Boudelot Bryant, the husband and wife songwriting team, writing for them. They have some incredible ballads. That definitely had an effect where, I mean, Don and Phil were, their music was a lot more acceptable to families in the late 50s than Elvis was. I think a lot of parents were a lot more willing to listen to the Everly Brothers than Elvis, just because of that sweet harmony. And, there might be the cheeky line here or there in their music, but generally songs like All I Have to Do Is Dream are devoted to you. They're more classy. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely had an effect where, whereas my music in the Jancks was a lot more almost like writing for characters that were, sometimes not the greatest characters. Some of the material was kind of crass at times in that group, and with a little bit of a punk energy to it, an irreverent energy. And like that has changed. My tastes and sensibilities have changed over the years. And I guess traveling the country, my heart has changed in terms of my relationship with the Lord as well. All those things have definitely shaped me in terms of content. When it comes to the sound, the aesthetic sound of the music is a whole other layer to it. That has really shaped me. So the music that I'm typically writing now, I didn't use a lot of distorted guitars anymore. I used to play really kind of heavier stuff. Like think of Led Zeppelin or Cream or Jimi Hendrix. They still used clean guitar sounds back then as well. But I generally these days, I don't like big bashing drum sounds. I love wet, well-crafted songs, and I want the vocals to shine. So I put a lot of cleaner guitars and really tight arrangements of songs that are more heartfelt and to the point, I suppose.
Back to your concert that will benefit Falling Creek Players and its efforts to establish summer musical theater in Pelican Rapids, and also the next day at the Sibley Center in Stanley. What does it mean to bring a show to a community instead of just performing? You're actually supporting. What does that mean?
I could say it's the icing on the cake, but in some ways it's really the cake. It's an honor to serve in some way. I'm just grateful I get to go out and play music and make a little bit of a living to be able to maybe make a difference in a community is very, very sweet. When we perform, my favorite part of playing is going out into the lobby or the foyer or wherever at the venue and getting to talk with people and just connect with folks, whether, you know, they have any stories about, you know, seeing acts over the years or if they play music or if they sing with their family. These are the things that stick with me the most is meeting people. So, yeah, I mean, that's just really sweet. I'm glad that we're helping in some way.
Zach, we live in the world of Spotify, right, and YouTube and all of those things that existed, you know, long after the Everly brothers were creating music, yet their music still resonates. Why is that?
I mean, it was such a unique time in not just in American music history, but just in America, mid-20th century. We're talking post-World War II through the early 70s. That particular time was really unique for music. I mean, one, you had to be pretty good to make records because you had to perform these things live on the spot. But again, it was just a unique time in terms of all these genres coming together, and things had not been overly defined yet. So, you know, the Everlys are, I think they're either the first or one of the first to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Country Music Hall of Fame. They had crossover hits in the same way that, you know, Chuck Berry had crossover hits. And so it's just interesting to me that there was a time in America where, do you call a Bob Wills song country, or do you call it rock and roll, or do you call it blues? Like, it's all these things just like mixed into one. And I feel like that was a really special time for American music where the lines were kind of blurred. And that, in conjunction with technology, the first electric instruments, the first electric guitars, louder amplification, and recording techniques, they just defined that era, and it's never to be repeated again. So, you know, even though there's still good music that's coming out to this day, I'd say that the 50s and 60s will never be repeated in that way. And that's why we all want to listen to those recordings, because it's just, it's like looking at an old photo. Like, we don't use that technology anymore, and there's just something incredible about it. The Everlys, you can't mistake the artist for the wave that they rode. And even Don and Phil know that. They were incredible talents, but they rode a wave. They got lucky with having the Bryants riding for them and with being in the right place at the right time. And
the good news is that we still get to experience it through you, Zach, and I appreciate it. The Everly Brothers Experience, featuring Zach and his brother Dylan, along with the Drummonds, begins Friday at 7 p.m. at the Pelican Rapids High School Fine Arts Auditorium. Doors open at 6 o'clock. I'm told that tickets are very reasonably priced and then can be purchased at eventbrite.com. All seats are general admission. They also are playing a show the next day in Stanley, North Dakota. That's August 8th, and that show also begins at 7 o'clock at the Sibley Center. Zach, it has been an absolute pleasure. Welcome back to the area, and thanks so much for joining us on Main Street. You'll have to pick up your skates maybe on one of your trips back here someday.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to do that. I've never actually skated on a pond before, so I hope to do that someday.
Plenty of opportunity here, Zach. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. When they migrate, tiny songbirds that spend most of their lives on land fly hundreds of miles over the ocean at a stretch, and they get tired. That's why the first stretch of coast along a migration route often has thousands of exhausted birds landing and taking a break. There are also stories about ships at sea hosting worn-out migratory birds. But for the most part, scientists saw those as rare events. But a study published in 2022 suggests it could be more common than once thought. A group of oceanographers spent a few weeks in the Mediterranean Sea and noticed something unusual. Nearly every day that summer, more than one bird would land on their boat and spend a few minutes or a few hours aboard before flying away. And they weren't just seabirds like gulls. They were land birds that don't frequent the high seas, apparently catching their breath on the boat and then resuming their epic journeys. The researchers think that there are now enough ships in the busy Mediterranean trade routes that some birds might use them as stopover sites when the weather turns bad. Like any expert traveler, birds know how to use their resources to make it to their destination. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 5th. In spite of the clear skies and wide open spaces, North Dakota ranks among states with the fewest UFO sightings. Unidentified flying objects just do not seem very interested in North Dakota. One possible explanation is the state's low population density. There are simply fewer people to notice what's happening in the sky. South Dakota has similar results. California appears to be the UFO capital with more than 16,000 historical reports. Despite the fact that they are few and far between, North Dakota does have its share of UFO sightings. Many are very basic, with people simply reporting that they saw a strange object or light in the sky. A typical report from a Fargo resident said he saw a light appear out of nowhere, traveling northwest at a speed I have never seen before, and then lights disappeared, no sounds, followed by a second one that did the same thing. Some reports are more difficult to dismiss. The so-called Gorman dogfight took place in 1948 in the skies over Fargo. The report came from George Gorman, a fighter pilot and World War II veteran. For nearly half an hour, he pursued what appeared to be a ball of light that made deliberate maneuvers before the unidentified object disappeared into the distance. On this date in 1953, another significant sighting occurred in North Dakota. More than 40 people witnessed it, including military personnel. In addition to eyewitness accounts, the object was tracked by radar. It was first spotted over Ellsworth Air Force Base before moving toward Bismarck. Witnesses described it as a red light that appeared to move deliberately. The light turned green when the object increased speed. Project Blue Book was the United States Air Force program for investigating UFO reports. It operated from 1952 to 1969. Investigators were often skeptical of reported sightings. Because this case involved air and ground visual observations, as well as air and ground radar tracking, Project Blue Book sent an investigator to conduct an in-person assessment. The report was verified by witnesses on the ground, ground radar tracking, and a pursuit of the object by a jet interceptor that also locked onto it with radar. The maneuvers were independently verified, and the case remains classified as unknown. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
I am Cole Maring, and I am from Fargo, North Dakota. I choose to be a Prairie Public Sustainer because of the myriad programs that they have that I find really valuable. Give me a more nuanced view of the world, introduce me to new great music. Oh, I think others should support Prairie Public for the same reason I do. These things don't just happen without us supporting them. Stuff that you're never going to hear, but you're going to love when you do hear it. Yeah, favorite programs and shows. I like to hear my Dakota Datebook every day. I really like Into the Music with Mike Olson. I liked the previously the Thomas Jefferson Hour with Clay Jenkinson. Just really, really great stuff. My favorite Prairie Public Radio personality, I would have to say, is Dave Thompson. I think that we just need to really do our best to appreciate it more and more.
You could be like Cole and become a sustaining member of Prairie Public today. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the donate tab.
And that's a wrap for this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, rising hunger in the state and falling water across North Dakota, plus ChatGPT now connects to health data. What does that mean? And the future of radio. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.